Beloved Bhagwan, throughout the sutras, the Buddha tells mortals they can achieve enlightenment by performing such meritorious works as building monasteries, casting statues, burning incense, scattering flowers, lighting eternal lamps, practicing all six periods of the day and night, walking around stupas, observing fasts, and worshipping. But if beholding the mind includes all other practices, then such works as these would appear redundant. The sutras of the Buddha contain countless metaphors. Because mortals have shallow minds and don't understand anything deep, the Buddha used the tangible to represent the sublime. People who seek blessings by concentrating on external works instead of internal cultivation are attempting the impossible. What you call a monastery, we call a sangrama, a place of purity. But whoever denies entry to the three poisons and keeps the gates of his senses pure, his body and mind still, inside and outside clean, builds a monastery. Casting statues refers to all practices cultivated by those who seek enlightenment. And burning incense doesn't mean ordinary material incense, but the incense of the intangible Dharma, which drives away filth, ignorance, and evil deeds with its perfume. When the Buddha was in the world, he told his disciples to light such precious incense with the fire of awareness, as an offering to the Buddhas of the Ten Directions. But people today don't understand the Tathagata's real meaning. They use an ordinary flame to light material incense of sandalwood or frankincense, hoping for some future blessing that never comes. For scattering flowers, the same holds true. This refers to speaking the Dharma or to scattering flowers of virtue in order to benefit others and glorify the real self. If you think the Tathagata meant for people to harm plants by cutting off their bloom, you're wrong. Those who observe the precepts don't injure any of the myriad life forms of heaven and earth. If you hurt something by mistake, you suffer for it. But those who intentionally break the precepts by injuring the living for the sake of future blessings suffer even more. How could they let would-be blessings turn into sorrows? The eternal lamp represents perfect awareness. Long ago, there was a Buddha named Dipamkara, or lamplighter. This was the meaning of his name. The light released by a Buddha from one curl between his brows can illuminate countless worlds. An oil lamp is no help. Practicing all six periods of the day and night means, among the six senses, constantly cultivating enlightenment and persevering in every form of awareness. Never relaxing control over the six senses is what's meant by all six periods. As for walking around stupas, the stupa is your body and mind. When your awareness circles your body and mind without stop, this is called walking around a stupa. The same holds true for observing a fast. To fast means to regulate. To regulate your body and mind so that they're not distracted or disturbed. Also, once you stop eating the food of delusion, if you touch it again, you break your fast. And once you break it, you reap no blessing from it. The world is full of deluded people who don't see this. They indulge their body and mind in all manner of evil. They give free rein to their passions and have no shame. And when they stop eating ordinary food, they call it fasting. How absurd! It's the same with worshipping. You have to understand the meaning and adapt to conditions. Meaning includes action and non-action. Worship means reverence and humility. It means revering your real self and humbling delusions. If you can wipe out evil desires and harbor good thoughts, even if nothing shows, it's worship. Those who fail to cultivate the inner meaning and concentrate instead on the outward expression never stop indulging in ignorance, hatred, and evil while exhausting themselves to no avail. They can deceive others with postures, remain shameless before sages, and vain before mortals, but they'll never escape the wheel, much less achieve any merit.
I am deeply hurt to say that Bodhidharma has gone senile. He he was going so great up to the point when the question was asked, from where ignorance comes. He lost track. It often happens if you lie once, you have to lie 1001 times more. Each lie needs another lie to protect it. And still, it remains unprotected. Instead of one lie, now you have to protect two lies. And the lies cannot be protected by truth. So you bring a third lie, and this is an endless series. That's what has happened to Bodhidharma. Because he could not simply say, I don't know. Now he is in a dilemma. Whatever is asked, he has to give some answer, whether he knows or not. And there are things which cannot be known by their very nature. So it was not at all a calamity to accept that this is an ultimate question, and ultimate questions cannot be answered, neither by Bodhidharma nor by anybody else, past, present, or future. The ultimate will remain always a mystery. You cannot demystify it by giving an answer. The moment you face the ultimate, you have to be simply just like a child and innocent. Enjoy the wonder of it, relish the mystery of it, in the depths of your heart, in the silences of your being, let it reach, let it penetrate you and transform you. It is not a question to ask about it or to expect any answer about it. But Bodhidharma took only one single wrong step. And now he is going on down the drain. Each day he has to go on creating lies unnecessarily. Once in a while, he says something true, but now the amount of truth goes on lessening and the lies are becoming more and more. Their quantity goes on increasing. I had never thought it, that a man like Bodhidharma was not courageous enough to simply say to the ultimate question that, forgive me, I don't know. If he had said that and stopped there, he would have risen to millions of mystics in height, in depth, in magnificence. But I can understand the problem. He did not want to disappoint his disciples. He did not want to disappoint the Chinese people. He did not want to know them that there are fundamental questions which even an enlightened person cannot answer. So he goes on fabricating fictions. He cannot say the Buddha is wrong, so he has to produce strange meanings which don't fit at all with what Buddha has said, and they don't fit absolutely at all what Bodhidharma himself has said before. His whole teaching was being aware of the mind and go beyond the mind. And that was absolutely perfect. Nothing was to be added to it. Now he is answering questions reluctantly. But he cannot stop. It needs tremendous courage to ignore your disciples' questions. And to say simply that this is not a question because it is ultimate. He has been trying in every way to satisfy the disciples and to satisfy the Chinese people that an enlightened man knows everything. The reality is not so. The more you become enlightened, the less you know. At the ultimate peak of enlightenment, you simply know yourself and nothing else. But at that peak, you yourself are the whole universe. I will tell you where he is still right, because he knows what is the truth. But he is compromising. He is not a rebel. He is a pacifying person. He does not want to say a single word to disturb the newly converted Buddhists in China. It would have been right if he had remained in India and never gone to China. here he would have been his real self. There was no need even to consider others. The moment you start considering others, you fall from the height. As far as I am concerned, my absolute commitment is towards the truth. Even if I irritate and annoy the whole world, I will not say anything just to console them. And I will not say anything that goes against my experience of truth. People have been asking me why the whole world is against you. The world is not against me. I am against the world. Because I have chosen truth. And I will say only that which is absolutely my experience, and I will not in any way compromise for any reason whatsoever. But Bodhidharma started compromising. He may have been worshipped by people because he consoled them. But in my eyes, he has lost his grandeur. He has lost his beauty and intelligence. He has come too low just to be understood. This is the question of a disciple. Throughout the sutras, the Buddha tells mortals they can achieve enlightenment by performing such meritorious works as building monasteries, casting statues, burning incense, scattering flowers, lighting eternal lamps, practicing all six periods of the day and night, walking around stupas. Stupas are the graves of ancient enlightened people. Observing fasts and worshipping. In fact, this whole sutra is an invention by the Mahayana school of Buddhism. Buddha never said anything like that. And if he said it, he was wrong. That should have been Bodhidharma's simple approach. Because even at the time of death, his last words were, "Don't make my statues." And you have heard Bodhidharma in the beginning saying, Buddhas cannot worship Buddhas. There is no need. And it is really humiliating. You have the same quality of consciousness within you, just you have not discovered it. Somebody else has discovered it. But as far as having it is concerned, you both have it in the same way. He mentioned the name of Dipankara. He was an ancient Buddha, before Gautam Buddha. And Gautam Buddha in Dipankara's time was an ordinary man. And just out of curiosity, he has gone to see Dipankara. He was given the name Dipankara because his presence was so infectious that those who came close to him innocently immediately caught something invisible, as if a flame has jumped from Dipankara into their heart, which was utterly dark, and now there is light. Hence the name was given to him, Dipankara Buddha, a man who lights the unlit lamps of others just by his presence. Gautam Buddha was not enlightened in that time, but he had gone just out of curiosity, like a small child. What is happening? Why so many people are going there? His curiosity was innocent. He has not gone to attain knowledge or enlightenment or anything. There was no greed in it. There was no ambition in it. It was simply the wonder that he heard that people who go to Dipankara, just sitting silently with him, something transpires and they return home a totally different person. Their actions change, their lifestyle changes, they become more loving, more compassionate. Greed disappears, ambition disappears, anger disappears. They become individuals so beautiful and so fragrant that he wanted to see this man. This man is a wonder. He does nothing. The master never does anything. His whole work is somehow to bring you close. So close as if you bring one candle which is burning with a flame close to another candle which is unlit. There is a certain point when the unlit candle will catch fire from the flame of the lit candle. The lit candle will not lose anything, but the unlit will gain a tremendous treasure. Unlit, it was dead. And when the flame has started, life has come to it. Now it can also dispel darkness in the same way as the first flame was doing. Dipankara was such a man. In fact, every great master is such a man. Whatever happens around him is not done by him. Whatever is done is just to bring you close. Make himself available to you and a mystery to you, that without your knowing, you are pulled like a magnet pulls things, and at a certain distance, suddenly you become a fire. The old dies and the new man is born. This sutra is absolutely wrong. It is not a statement of Gautama Buddha. Because a man of his understanding cannot say to people that they can achieve enlightenment by performing such meritorious works as building monasteries, casting statues, burning incense. Can you see any connection with enlightenment, with burning incense? You can burn mountains of incense. There is no logical relationship with your becoming enlightened. You may got burned, that's the only thing. Making monasteries, and you are not a monk. You are making monasteries for other fools to become monks. How that can become your enlightenment? How many monasteries Gautama Buddha has made before he became enlightened? How much incense he has burned? How many flowers he has scattered? How many eternal lamps he has burned? No, this statement is not at all of Gautama Buddha. It is the invention of the Mahayana school. A certain creed and doctrine. And there was a historical reason why such things were created. Buddha was very straightforward man. He said whatsoever was right, whatever the consequence. For example, he said that all the pandits and the scholars and the Brahmins are idiots. And they are parasites. For centuries they have been sucking blood of the people. He called Vedas just rubbish. And Vedas were so much respected by the Hindus that anybody calling Vedas rubbish must have had a great courage. He did not accept any Hindu avatara, Hindu incarnation of any value. For example, Parashuram is one of the Hindu incarnations of God. He was a son of a man who was thought to be a great seer. But he was suspicious, as all husbands are suspicious, about their wives. And all wives automatically are suspicious of their husbands. That is their only relationship. And finally he became so convinced of his suspicion, which may have any ground or may not have any ground, we cannot certain at this point, that he ordered his son Parashuram to cut his mother's head and bring it to him. And he went without asking why. It was not a small thing. He cut the mother's head and brought it to his father. Then the father told him that I have been suspecting, but now I have certain evidences that she has been in love with a man who is a great warrior. Parashurama and his family belong to the caste of the Brahmins. He said, you don't be worried. I will not leave a single man of the warrior race alive. The story may be exaggerated, but it shows the quality of the man. It shows that he killed all the warriors of the whole world many, many times. And from where these new warriors were coming? Because the Hindu society accepted a very strange thing, and nobody ever considers. They go on claiming they have a great culture, and they never look at their foundations, that their culture is just a phony name. The Hindu society accepted that if a woman comes to a Brahmin seer and asks that she should be given a child, then it is obligatory that the Brahmin seer cannot reject her. He has to make love to her and make her pregnant. So Parasurama went on cutting the heads of the warriors, and the widows were left, and they were going to the seers. It was a good business, a great conspiracy. The whole country was in a state of prostitution. And the people who were involved was Parasurama was killing, and such violence cannot be accepted as a quality of God. And it seems illogical, even if his mother was in love with one Brahmin, one warrior, he could have killed him. We can give few concessions because he was thought by the Hindus as incarnation of God. But to kill all the warriors of the world, not only of this country, does not seem to have any logic behind it. And it was not certain what the father was saying. He should have asked for the evidence, for the proof. It may have been just a jealous man. Now, Buddha cannot accept Parasuram as a reincarnation of God. And if Parasuram is a reincarnation of God, then who will be the reincarnation of devil? He cannot accept Rama to be the incarnation of God, because Rama killed a Sudra, a young man, by pouring hot liquid lead into his ears, because he has been hearing, hiding behind a tree, when few Brahmins were reciting Vedas. The Sudras are not allowed to read, they are not allowed even to listen. What kind of culture this country has created, where 1/4 of the people are not even allowed to listen its religious scriptures. And because this young man, just out of curiosity, hiding behind a tree, listened, although he could not understand it, because it was in Sanskrit, and Sanskrit has never been the language of the people. It has always been the language of the priests, only of the priests. So even if he has listened, he has not understood anything. And do you think, is it a crime worth to destroy a young man by pouring hot, boiling lead into his ears because he has committed a sin by listening the Vedas, and the man died. Buddha could not accept Rama. Buddha could not accept Krishna. A man who was so mad that he collected 16,000 women, any woman that he fancied was taken away from her family. She may be a virgin, she may be married, she may have children, she may have husband, she may have to look after the old father-in-law, the old mother-in-law. 16,000 women was just simply taken away by his soldiers. They were treated as if they are cattle. And I don't know he had even remembered the names of those 16,000 women. But he was powerful. And he has a great army. And he was a great king. Buddha cannot accept such nonsense. Such corrupted men as a reincarnation of God. Buddha was very straightforward. He said that all the statues, all the temples, all the Vedas are creations of a cunning priesthood to exploit people. How can he say to his own people that you can attain enlightenment by building monasteries, casting statues, burning incense, scattering flowers, lighting eternal lamps, practicing all six periods of the day and night, walking around stupas, observing fasts and worshipping? He was against worship, he was against the statues. His last words before his death, he said, "Again I remind you, don't make my statues, don't create temples in my name. Don't start worshipping me." Because worshipping is not going to lead you anywhere. I have shown you the path of meditation. Meditate. And if even in your meditation I appear, don't hesitate. Immediately cut my head. A man who can say this, can you think this sutra is possible to come from him? Bodhidharma could have simply said that these are not the words of Buddha. but he could not say. That's where he falls low into my eyes. He could not say because in China the Buddhists were trying to make as many monasteries, as many temples, as many statues. One temple exists in China with 10,000 Buddha statues. The whole mountain has been carved as a temple. This is the biggest temple in the world where 10,000 statues of Buddha are there. And to say anything that this is not right would go against the very Buddhist who has been working in converting the Chinese. And they were giving the certainty that you will become enlightened. If you feed the monks, if you worship the Buddha, if you give donations to the monasteries, he must have hesitated a moment. But finally, he fell into the trap of being part of an organized religion. The organized religion always insists on these stupid things, which don't lead you anywhere. But they help the organized religion to exploit you. Otherwise, who is going to feed 1 million Catholic nuns and monks? Who is going to take care of all the expenses of thousands of Catholic monasteries? It has to be continuously emphasized by the sermons of the priest every Sunday, reminded that donate, that donation will bring you salvation. Salvation is the Christian word for enlightenment. The disciples can see it, so they are asking, but if beholding the mind includes all other practices, then such works as these would appear redundant. If a single method of beholding the mind creates enlightenment, then what is the need of all these things? These are all things out of the mind. They will strengthen the mind. And all that you have to do is to weaken the mind. Go beyond it, so beyond that it cannot take any energy from you and dies out of hunger and starvation. And when you don't have any mind, but just a pure silence of no mind, you have attained enlightenment. The disciples are perfectly right to ask the question that you yourself have been saying, just behold the mind, and that's enough. Then what is the need of all these rituals? Now he is caught in a catch-22. If he says these words are not from Buddha, he goes against Mahayana Buddhism and he belongs to that sect. That's why I insist, don't belong to any sect, to any creed, to any religion, otherwise you cannot be absolutely committed to truth. Any other commitment side by side with the commitment of truth is dangerous. Then you would like somehow to console that other commitment also. And if a man like Bodhidharma could not manage to say the truth, because he could see if he says it, and he was the first enlightened man entering China. If he says it, the whole edifice that in 600 years thousands of Buddhist monks has created, the whole atmosphere that you can become enlightened by worshipping Buddha, by burning incense, by offering flowers, by making temples, statues, monasteries, will simply flop, because none of them was enlightened. And the whole China was waiting from an enlightenment to hear what is actually the truth. But because he also belongs to a certain business firm, he decided rather in favor of the business than in favor of the truth. I have always told a small story. A small school, a Christian school, but the only one in the vicinity. And little kids, and the teacher is telling them for almost 1 hour that Jesus Christ is the greatest man who has walked on the earth. And then she asked the students, who is the greatest man that has walked on the earth? One American boy student said, Abraham Lincoln. She said, not bad, but not quite right. An English girl stood up and said, Winston Churchill. The woman could not believe that 1 hour she has wasted insisting a single point. She said, not bad, but not yet quite right. And then A little boy who never used to speak stood up, raising his hand. So the teacher said, "You never do that. For the first time you are raising your hand." And she was afraid that his answer is not going to be right, certainly. But the boy said, "Jesus Christ." She was shocked with the previous two answers, but this answer was even more shocking, because the boy was Jewish. After the class, she caught hold of the boy, took him aside and said, "Jaime." "Are not you a Jew?" He said, "Yes, I am." "Then do you really think Jesus Christ is the greatest man who has walked on the earth?" He laughed. He said, "Business is business. In the deepest of my heart, I know Moses is the man, not Jesus Christ. These are just pygmies. But business is business." Because there was a big trophy to be given to the person who answered the right question, and Jaime was carrying the bigger trophy, bigger than himself. But you can forgive a small child, although he is very logical. That what does it matter if I say once in a class, just to win the game, "Jesus Christ," because I know the rules, who is going to win? Why unnecessarily bring Moses and get defeated? But in the deepest of my heart, I know Moses is the greatest man who has ever walked on the earth. But even people who are enlightened, when it comes to decide between their commitment with an organized religion and their commitment for truth, decide for the commitment of the organization. This is really sad. The answer he gives is simply irrelevant. Just trying to make something that can prove that the sutra is spoken by Buddha. I absolutely deny such a statement cannot be spoken by Buddha. It goes against his very life, his very teaching, his very way. Bodhidharma says, the sutras of the Buddha contain countless metaphors. Now you can see the trick. Now he cannot say it is wrong, and he cannot say it is right. He finds a middle way. That Buddha is speaking in metaphors. Because mortals have shallow minds, and whom he is speaking to, the mortals or to the immortals? If Buddha's audience had shallow minds, does Bodhidharma think that his audience is of higher status? Buddha has perhaps the most intelligent audience any man ever had. Bodhidharma is talking to the recently converted Buddhists. The Buddha used the tangible to represent the sublime. This is tricky and unforgivable. People who seek blessings by concentrating on external works instead of internal cultivation are attempting the impossible. But the truth he knows. So once in a while it comes up. With all effort to suppress it and to go with the crowd and the mass mind. This is true when he says concentrating on external works instead of internal cultivation are attempting the impossible. But that's what the sutra says. Now the only way is to make it a metaphor. What you call a monastery, we call a Sangharama. A place of purity. That is absolutely wrong. Sangharama is exactly a monastery. It is not different from a monastery. It is not a metaphor. And even for these 2,000 years in China, thousands of monasteries have existed. Just it is after the communist revolution, 30 years before, many monasteries have been destroyed. Otherwise, millions of monks were living on people's blood. But they are coming back. Because it was Mao Zedong's very adamant and stubborn and fascist and communist mind that he turned the monasteries into hospitals, into schools, and forced the monks to go to the fields and work. He stopped begging. And Buddhism has lived only on begging.
In fact, begging has been a discipline, a practice, because it makes you humble. But he made it illegal to beg and forced the monks to work for their food, for their clothes, for their shelter. But Mao is dead and his enemies in the Communist Party have come into power, whom he was not allowing. Many of them were forced into jail. Many have been killed. Now the opposite party inside the Communist Party itself has come, and it wants to win the heart of the people. Monasteries are coming back again, because 2000 years Buddhism cannot be erased so easily. Now Buddhist monks can be seen again with their begging bowls. Those hospitals have been removed, those schools have been removed, and monks are no more forced to work in the fields or in the factories or wherever they can be of any use. But whoever denies entry to the three poisons and keeps the gates of his senses pure, his body and mind is still inside and outside clean, builds a monastery. Now this is a very far-fetched idea, and if Bodhidharma can explain it to very new candidates to Buddhism, why not Buddha himself said it, that he is speaking in metaphors, and he could have explained himself, and he was far better as far as speaking is concerned, far more articulate. He could have explained that these are just metaphors, but nowhere he mentions them as metaphors. And it is very arduous for Bodhidharma to turn everything into a metaphor. And we will see, with everything he goes on with the idea that they are metaphors. Casting statues refers to all practices cultivated by those who seek enlightenment. I cannot understand how this can be the metaphor. Casting statues refers to all practices cultivated by those who seek enlightenment. What relationship, even far-fetched? A metaphor should be representative. It should explain something. It should be helpful to understand. This is not at all concerned with casting statues and practicing for enlightenment. Could not Buddha himself say, practice for enlightenment? And burning incense does not mean ordinary material incense, as if there is somewhere available some spiritual incense. But the incense of the intangible dharma, where you are going to get it? That's why I said it hurts me to say that Bodhidharma seems to have gone senile, although he was only 75. Which drives away filth. Ignorance and evil deeds with its perfume. Great, but where to get it? That spiritual incense which drives away filth, ignorance and evil deeds with its perfume, nobody has ever seen such a thing. Otherwise, life would have been so simple. There is no need of bothering people for meditation, for any discipline, for any awareness. Just burn the spiritual incense and everything is driven out and you are purified by the perfume. Just I will not be enlightened because I am allergic to perfume, whether it is tangible or intangible. But there is not much harm. If one man is not enlightened, it can be tolerated, but the whole world will be enlightened. I am perfectly ready. And he is not even aware that how long he can deceive people. But he has deceived for 1,000 years. These sutras have been in existence. And certainly because they were in the hands of the Mahayana Buddhists and they were not willing them to be translated. And I can understand now why they were not willing them to be translated. They will destroy the great image of Bodhidharma. They themselves may have understood that it is absolutely outlandish what he is talking about. When the Buddha was in the world, he told his disciples to light such precious incense with the fire of awareness as an offering to the Buddhas of the 10 directions. It may be precious, but where it is available? And then he makes awareness as a fire, just to burn the incense. And incense will do everything. You will become enlightened. So now your soul search is to find that dharma incense, that spiritual incense Perhaps you can find it in Pune. It is a very spiritual city. So spiritual that only spirits roam around. No living human beings. But people today don't understand the Tathagata's real meaning. Only Bodhidharma understands the Tathagata's real meaning. Perhaps Tathagata himself did not understand his own real meaning. They use an ordinary flame to light material incense of sandalwood or frankincense, hoping for some future blessings that never comes. He is going round about and round about. He could have simply said that this statement is not a Buddha. And this statement is absolutely nonsense. And that would have been absolutely correct. For scattering flowers, the same holds true. This refers to speaking the Dharma, or to scattering flowers of virtue. How do you scatter flowers of virtue? Even if one accepts this stupid explanation, but how do you scatter the flowers of virtue? You go on giving people that this is truth, this is love, this is compassion, and your hand is empty. Two madmen in a madhouse were sitting in the park. Every day, 1 hour, they were allowed to go out in the garden. And one man was keeping his fist and asked the other, "If you tell me what I am keeping in my fist, I will give you 1 rupee. The other man said, "Really? Will you keep your word?" The first man took out 1 rupee from his pocket and said, "This is the rupee. Just tell me what is in my hand." And the other man looked and said, "It seems it is an elephant." And the first man says, "You cannot get the rupee. It seems you have looked." You are being tricky. He did not give the 1 rupee because he also believed he is keeping an elephant in his fist. How can you scatter flowers of virtue in order to benefit others and glorify the real self? If you think the Tathagata meant for people to harm plants by cutting off their bloom, you are wrong. That seems to be right. But he is mixing everything in such a way that it loses all significance. Certainly Buddha will not like to pluck flowers. It is killing. The flower on the rose bush has a life. A beauty. The moment you pluck it, it is dead. Leave it there. Mukta is my gardener. She is not allowed even to cut any leaf or to cut any flowers. In the beginning, she used to move with a gardener's scissor hiding behind her bed. But right now I can see, whenever I go to the Buddha hall, otherwise I don't get out, I can see flowers are there. I can see the garden has become a jungle. So she must have dropped that gardener's scissor. Let every tree grow in its own way. At least in my garden, don't kill any tree, don't destroy any living flower. So I can understand that Buddha would not have allowed cutting off their bloom, but rather than saying directly that the whole sutra is inserted by the Mahayana school. And why Mahayana school has to insert such things? There is something very fundamental to be understood. As Gautam Buddha worked in this country 25 centuries before, he almost converted the whole land. He was such a man of charisma. He was not just a learned man, he has known existence, he has been part of it, his impact was tremendous. Perhaps nobody else had ever such an impact. But the moment he died, the Brahmins, the priests come out of their caves where they were hiding, because they could not face Gautam Buddha, and whoever went to face him became a disciple. But they were waiting for their chance. One day he is going to die. He has destroyed their whole profession. Now no bells were ringing in the temples. People were not going to worship. People were not calling Brahmins for their rituals. And Brahmins are the most clever priesthood in the whole world. They get caught, the person when he is born, immediately he is under their control, some ritual. Then his birth chart has to be made. Then his naming ceremony has to be. And in all these, the priest is exploiting people. Then saving the head. And this goes on and on. Then marriage. Even if you go out of the house to some other city, you have to consult the Brahmin, the right time, the right congregation of the stars, whether to go north or to south, or to east or to west. What will be the most appropriate time and beneficial? Then comes marriage, then again the priest is there. And then after the marriage, children start coming from the new marriage and the priest is there. And then the man becomes old. From the cradle to the grave, the priest keeps his hold. Even after the man has died, there are rituals to be performed. And in a poor country, those rituals cost so much that people have to sell their houses, their lands, their possessions, on which they were dependent for their livelihood. Because their father has died, now they have to give a great feast for Brahmins. And even your forefathers who have died, and it must have been a long line, unending line, in fact, millions of people in every queue behind everybody. For that they have a special time. 1 month completely devoted to the forefathers, because the number is big. So 1 month continuous rituals, fire worship, mantras, chanting, for the peace of all those who have died in your family, you don't know even their name. And millions must have died. Scientists calculate that wherever you are sitting, at least 8 persons' graves are underneath you. Don't be afraid. They are dead. But so many people have died. So even after thousands of years the man has died, the priest is still exploiting you. Buddha has created a tremendous revolution in this sense that he destroyed the whole integrity of the priesthood. But the moment he died, the priests came back. And people were also missing them. Life has become very simple. The child is born, no priest is chanting for a blissful long life for him. Somebody dies and the priest is not there chanting. And blessing him for the great journey he has gone on. People were also missing all these rituals. So as Buddha died, slowly Brahmins were back. And they started driving out the Buddhists from the land. Just 50 years before, in India there was not a single Buddhist. In these 50 years, one man has done a great service, although he himself was not a religious man. He was a politician, but by accidentally he had to do something. It was his political tactics. Baba Saheb Ambedkar. He was a Sudra, but caught the eyes of a very rich man, because he was so intelligent that he sent him to study to England, and he became one of the great experts of law in the world. He has made the Constitution of India. But he was continuously fighting for the Sudras whom he belonged. And that is 1/4 of the Hindu society. And he wanted a separate vote for the Sudras. And he was absolutely right. I don't see why they should belong to the Hindu fold, which has tortured them for 10,000 years and forced them to do every ugly work and paid them almost nothing. They are not even allowed to live in the cities, they live outside the city. Just before freedom, they were not allowed to move in many streets of the town. In many places, they were forced to announce loudly that I am a Sudra and I am passing from here. Those who can hear me, please move out of the way. Because even their shadows falling on you defile you. But finding no way, because Mahatma Gandhi was insistent that Sudras should not leave Hindu fold, that was also a political strategy. Because if 1/4 of Hindus leave the fold, then Hindus will become a minority in their own country. There are Mohammedans, there are Christians, there are Jainas, and now a new big chunk will go out of the Hindu fold. The country of the Hindus will become almost the country of others. If they all get together, Hindus will never be in power. I don't consider Mahatma Gandhi a religious man either. He belongs to the same category as Dr. Ambedkar. He went on a fast unto death. That Ambedkar has to take his stand back. He has to withdraw the idea that Sudras should be given a separate vote. And he was clever enough. He started calling Sudras Harijanas. Cunning people always play with words. Words don't make any difference whether you call them Sudras, untouchables, or Harijans. Harijans means children of God. I had a long discussion with Mahatma Gandhi's son Ramdas that don't you see the cunningness? The children of God have been suffering for 10,000 years, and those who are not children of God are exploiting them, torturing them, oppressing them, raping their women, burning their towns completely with all the living people inside. If these are the children of God, it is better not to be children of God. This is dangerous. But he changed the name just to give it a beautiful meaning. But everything inside remained the same. And he went for a fast unto death unless Ambedkar takes his statement back. If I was in place of Ambedkar, I would have told Mahatma Gandhi, it is your business to live or to die. It is your business. If you want to fast, you are free. Fast unto death or even beyond. But Ambedkar was pressurized from all over the country, because if Gandhi dies, the whole blame will come on Ambedkar. And I should have told to Gandhi that this is a very violent method, and you have been talking about non-violence. This is non-violence. It happened, I was in Raipur teaching in the Sanskrit college there. And a very beautiful young girl was asked by a very gangster that she should be married to him. He was a dangerous man, a criminal. He has been to jails many times. He has committed many crimes. And he was almost of the age of the girl's father. But he took the fancy and he, seeing the success of Gandhi, fasting unto death, he manages everything. Because he managed Ambedkar. Just after 21 days, when his health started falling fast, and doctors said, do something, otherwise the old man will be gone. Ambedkar was so much pressurized by all the Indian national leaders that go to Mahatma Gandhi, ask for apology, and offer him a glass of orange juice to break his fast and take your movement back. Otherwise, you will be remembered always as one who killed the greatest man of this country. A great religious man. And Ambedkar had to do it unwillingly. I would not have done it. I would have accepted the blame. I would have accepted the history's condemnation. Who cares when you are dead what is written in history about you? At least you don't know what is written, and you don't read. Let them write anything, but I would have insisted that this is not a non-violent method. It is absolutely violent, but in a very subtle way. I threaten you to kill. This is violence. And I threaten myself to kill if you don't accept me. Is this logical? The standpoint that Gandhi was taking was absolutely illogical. But he supported it by threatening. It is blackmail that I will kill myself. Then Ambedkar managed another way. He started converting the Sudras into Buddhism. That's why now there are few lakhs of Buddhists, but they are not in any way religious. It is just a political maneuver. This man in Raipur went to the girl's house with a bed and declared that if the girl is not married to him, he is fasting unto death. It became the talk of the whole city. Photographers and journalists, and the whole day the crowd was there, and the father became afraid, and pressures started coming on him that why take the responsibility of his death. But the father said, this is absolutely ugly. He is my age and he is a criminal, and I cannot give my daughter to this man. I knew the father and the girl. The girl was my student in the college. The girl suggested his father to consult me. What has to be done? I had not known him before. He came to me and he told the whole story. I said, it is very simple. You just find out some old rotten prostitute. He said, what? I said, just listen the whole point. Find out a very rotten old bitch. And put another bed in front of your house. And the bitch declares that I'm going to do a fast unto death unless this man marries me. Except this, nothing will work. That man escaped in the middle of the night. He was never seen again, never asking. This is the Gandhian methodology, a very religious thing. The Buddhists were burnt, driven out of country, and the whole country was absolutely cleaned of all impact that Buddha has left. Even in the temple that has been raised in the memory of his enlightenment in Bodh Gaya, there was not even a Buddhist to take care of the temple. A Brahmin has been taking care for 2000 years, the same family, generation after generation. Now they have become the owners of the temple. They don't believe in Buddha. They are against Buddha. But the temple is very precious because from all over the world people come to the temple. Much money comes to the temple. And the priest is not concerned. He is earning lots of money and he is not willing to hand over the temple because for 2000 years it has been in his possession. No law can take it away from him. So when the Buddhists reached China, Tibet, they had learned a lesson that if you go against the people and their traditions, perhaps when a charismatic person is alive, you may seem winning the game, but when the charismatic person is gone, what has happened in India will happen in Tibet, will happen in China, will happen in Lanka, will happen in Japan. So they compromised. That was the reason to insert all these wrong sutras. So Buddhist scriptures in Tibet have different sutras to console and to convince the Buddhist population of Tibet. Chinese Mahayana sutras have different. In Sri Lanka, they have different. This is the historical reason why these absolutely absurd sutras, which cannot be of Buddha, have entered into the scriptures. They have been knowingly entered, because without them there was no question of survival. But as far as I am concerned, and as far as Bodhidharma should have been concerned, truth is the ultimate value, not survival. And survival by creating lies, by distorting the truth. What is the point? Even if Buddhism has disappeared from the whole world, it does not matter. But the purity of his statements should have been preserved. So whenever a seeker wants to search, he has not to get lost into a forest of unnecessary disciplines, rituals. Bodhidharma should have made it clear, I know the risk. I understand that he must have felt very guilty, because after these sutras he left China to the Himalayas. He must have felt tremendously hurt that what he is doing is against his own understanding. But I can still not forgive him. I cannot forgive anyone who goes against truth. Those who observe the precepts don't injure any of the myriad life forms of heaven and earth. If you hurt something by mistake, you suffer for it. But those who intentionally break the precepts by injuring the living for the sake of future blessings suffer even more. How could they let would-be blessings turn into sorrows? The eternal lamp represents perfect awareness. Only on this the metaphor seems to be correct. It can be interpreted as perfect awareness, the eternal lamp. But other metaphors he has not been able to relate to his interpretation. Long ago, there was a Buddha named Dipankara, or lamp lighter. This was the meaning of his name, the light released by a Buddha from one curl between his brows can illuminate countless worlds. An oil lamp is no help. Practicing all six periods of the day and night means, among the six senses, constantly cultivating enlightenment and preserving in every form of awareness. Never relaxing control over the six senses is what is meant by all these six periods. But these are contradictory to his own statements. Control is not needed because it is through the mind. Practice is not needed because it is through the mind. One has to live a life of let go. That was his basic teaching. One has to be spontaneous. One has to live moment to moment. Neither thinking of the past nor thinking of the future, and neither clinging to the present. He has given such beautiful sutras, and at the end he spoils his own work completely. As for walking around stupas, the stupa is your body and mind. When your awareness circles your body and mind, without stop, this is called walking around a stupa. Just he is trying to manage somehow even though the whole thing is so stupid. Stupas exist actually . And Buddhists of Mahayana school go on for pilgrimage to the stupas and go around them. And your body and mind is not a stupa. A stupa is when you are dead, then a grave has to be created for you. The Buddhist grave is called stupa. It is made in a certain round way. But your body and mind are alive. And how your consciousness can go around body and mind? He is not even taking in consideration that all his interpretations can be questioned. They were not questioned because they consoled the people. They wanted something tangible, and if it is a metaphor, no harm. He is not denying the Gautam Buddha. The same holds true for observing a fast. even a man of very small intelligence can see the stupidity. To fast means to regulate your body and mind. I cannot conceive how a fast can mean to regulate your body and mind so that they are not distracted or disturbed. Fast simply means fast and nothing else. Also, once you stop eating the food of delusion, if you touch it again, you break your fast. Now he has forgotten what he was saying. In fact, because that saying is not coming from his innermost being, it is just his mental gymnastics. He has forgotten that he has defined body and mind as istupa, and he has defined fasting as regulating your body, disciplining your body. Now, from where comes this idea? Once you stop eating the food of delusion, it was not in the very definition of the metaphor. Food was not brought in. If you stop eating the food of delusion, and is there any food that is not of delusion? Buddha also eats the same bread as you eat. And Buddha also drinks the same water as you drink. If you touch it again, not even eating, but even touching, and it is delusion. What harm is in touching a delusion? A delusion does not exist. You cannot touch it. Even if you touch it again, you break your fast. Now he has forgotten the metaphor that he has explained before. Now, even if you touch the delusion food, you have broken your fast. And once you break it, you reap no blessing from it. The world is full of deluded people who don't see this. They indulge their body and mind in all manner of evil. They give free rein to their passions and have no shame. And when they stop eating ordinary food, they call it fasting. How absurd! I agree only with the last. How absurd! It is the same with worshipping. You have to understand the meaning and adapt to conditions. Meaning includes action and non-action. He is just trying to deceive people, bringing words which have no relation at all. Worship means reverence and humility. That is true. It means revering your real self and humbling delusions. But if you know your real self, where you will find the delusions? both cannot exist together. Either you are awake, then the dreams are no more there, or the dreams are there, you are not awake. The man who knows his real self has no delusions, but he has got into a mess. And he is trying hard to get out of it, but he is getting deeper and deeper into it. If you can wipe out evil desires and harbor good thoughts, even if nothing shows, it is worship. Early in his sutras, he says one has to go beyond good and evil. Now good becomes worship. Those who fail to cultivate the inner meaning and concentrate instead on the outward expression never stop indulging in ignorance, hatred and evil while exhausting themselves to no avail. They can deceive others with postures, remain shameless before sages and vain before mortals, but they will never escape the wheel, much less achieve any merit. It is a strange compilation of sutras. He goes really deep, like a sharp sword, cutting all that is wrong, up to the point when he is asked the ultimate question, from where the ignorance arises. Because he cannot answer it, and he is not humble enough to accept that I don't know, he gets into such a mess that after that every question remains unanswered. Although he pretends to answer it, but it is not even related to the question. If this can happen to a man like Bodhidharma, you have to be aware. My insistence that don't belong to any religion, don't belong to any doctrine, don't belong to any scripture, is for the simple reason that your whole and total commitment should be for truth and not for anything else. Your commitment should not be divided, otherwise you will have to make such a compromise which will make anybody who understands feel that you have gone either insane or senile or mad. But one thing is certain, you have lost the path. He himself may not have, in his innermost core, lost his enlightenment. Enlightenment cannot be lost. But he has defiled it. his enlightenment is not anymore so clean, so bright. Not anymore a pillar of light. And just for the simple business of an organized religion, the humanity will never be religious unless all organized religions disappear and religion becomes an individual commitment towards existence. So no question of compromise arises. Let me say to you, religion is rebellious, and the man of religion is a rebel. He is rebellious against all orthodoxies, against all traditions, against all organizations, against all ideologies. His only love is for truth, and his whole love is for truth. Only such a man finds it. Others only wander into ignorance, into dreams, into sleep, and suffer. Okay, Manisha.
Yes, Bhagwan.
Thank you.